Insane.
Hey, this is Ross Bain with The Unspeakable, and we're here with Shane Ivey, Scott Blancy, Robin Laws, and Kenneth Height to talk about upcoming games in the Cthulhu Mythos vein, Trail of Cthulhu, Call of Cthulhu, and other horror-related stuff. So, Shane, you, with Arc Dream, have been releasing some new Call of Cthulhu material. So, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, we published this magazine called The Unspeakable Oath.
I think I've heard of it.
And we have a new issue out. In 2013, I think we're breaking records where we'll have possibly as many as two issues in a single year.
That's not bad for a quarter.
I may be overstepping my, you know, making that kind of a claim.
That's regional poetry quarter. Right.
That's what we're shooting
for. Is that the fourth seal when the Unspeakable Oath is twice in one calendar?
Yeah. So the new one is the new one. We, in fact, I thought I was going to have it here at Gen Con,
but until, somebody took too long getting his edits back to the editor.
Until the until I heard from the printer that there was no way they could physically do that. So, but yeah, it's going to be shipping out, mailing out to people in the next week or two.
People
and of course, the PDF is already out there, and the centerpiece of the new oath is of course Scott Glancy's 500-page end of Soviet Russia scenario.
Is it Dead Hand or Cold Dead Hand?
Cold Dead Hand.
Cold Dead Hand.
Yeah, we the RPPR group playtested that, and I will post that on the oath as well. Mm-hmm. And it's a great scenario. I mean, very seldom nuclear weapons come into play in Call of Cthulhu.
Just twice.
And yeah, so it's good. It's not actually 500 pages, but it is something along the lines of 50 out of the 80-page magazine. So it's Cold Dead Hand, and then a scattering of tiny, tiny little things.
Reviews.
Yeah.
I was very lucky that Shane was up for putting it in the oath because it's kind of an orphan. I mean, it's a scenario that had no home for years because it's actually set before
didn't quite
Delta
fit
Green.
in the source books.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very fun, and the playtesting went brilliantly. We got some amazingly good feedback from the playtesters, so it was good. And then we've also got the Sense of the Sleight of Hand Man in now that Dennis Detwiller wrote. It's a 300-page Call of Cthulhu campaign set almost entirely in the Dreamlands, and so if you've ever been fascinated by the Dreamlands source books and had and thought to yourself, I can't imagine what I would do in a game with this, we've got 300 pages to tell you.
And I think it's worth mentioning that the Dreamlands has always been sort of the ugly stepchild of Call of Cthulhu.
Or the too pretty stepchild.
Yeah, exactly. A little too pretty. It looks a little too nice. And Dennis fixed that.
Dennis
turned it into a nightmare world and did a beautiful job ugling it up.
Yeah, there's not much chance that you won't have your sanity sapped by this. So it's very good. We're very, very happy with it. So that's Scott. That's also been talking. And what's up with Pagan?
Hopefully, sometime this evening, after we end this, I'll be hijacking Ross to shoot the video for a new Kickstarter. Besides working on Delta Green material for the 2014 Delta Green book, Pagan's about to launch a Kickstarter for a World War I source book and adventure scenario anthology. We've been coming to Gen Con for the last 5 years bringing scenarios.
This is it. This is the transportation, planes, trains, and
submarines.
Submarines.
This is the one where we're going to bring the Horrors of War as the general working title right now. We have, at this point, between John Crow and myself, we've got like 400,000 words of material. What we're looking for now is print budget, ship budget, art and layout for the Kickstarter. And
how many words did you say?
It's over 400,000. 400,000 words
Christ.
Of material. We are not putting it all in one book. We're going to take 200,000 words out of what we've got, put it in one book.
That's still a beefy book.
It's going to be about Delta Green sized. Wow. We've budgeted for something about,
Over 300 pages.
Yeah, about 300 pages. And the idea being that we're not having any stretch goals that'll be like, you can get a bigger book, because if we get a bigger book, we'll be late. The goal is to get this book done by August 2014, thus making it the 100-year anniversary of the outbreak of World War I.
Right.
So we get our Guns of August release.
And then you're going to go beat an Austrian Archduke to death with it.
It'll be substantial enough, yes, that you could probably put... But the Habsburgs are a weak strain of nobility.
I learned that from 30 Rock.
Yeah. They've got hair lips and, you know, hemophilia, so it shouldn't really be a problem.
It's really a mercy killer.
Yeah. But we're hoping to have about 8 scenarios in it. The one that you played in, like, I mean, Ross and the RPPR people have played in a ton of these scenarios.
Yeah.
Not all of which will be in this volume. If we do get overloaded at the, if the Kickstarter does fund us more than, you know, what we're asking for, if it doubles that number, we'll put it towards volume 2, but the goal is to get volume 1 completed and out.
Yeah.
And since it is down to copy edits and it's been play tested and down to copy edit and layout, we think we can pull that off by 2014.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, that's the big thing. That and writing for Shane.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So Robin Laws is here with us now, next around the table. And what's up?
So Cthulhu-wise, the thing that I've been working on when I'm not working on Hellfolk, which is another game that I've got out, is my manuscript for Dreamhounds of Paris, which is the companion volume to Bookhounds of London. And it is another take on the Dreamlands
that
absolutely tackles that same problem you're talking about, which is that the Dunsinane Dreamlands are kind of uncool. No one would care about Lovecraft if all he'd written was the Dreamland stuff.
Is it squiggly and...
And the stuff that you like about the Dreamland stuff, which I kind of like some of it, is the stuff that invokes his horror material and his imagery. So we have a different take on how to make that horrifying that dovetails with the fact that Trail of Cthulhu is set in the 1930s, which is that the premise of this book is that you play as the player characters the major figures of the Surrealist movement in London in the 1930s. In Paris, the 1930s, thanks.
Right.
And so you play Salvador Dali, Louis Buñuel, Antoine Artaud, Paul Eluard, Man Ray,
René Magritte.
And
this is not a Shoggoth. I guess that would be really good.
Yes. Ceci ne upad de Shoggoth.
Right. And so the
deep one falling down the stairs.
Yes. And so the idea is that they discover that the Dreamlands historically, that the sort of Dunsinane Art Nouveau symbolist Dreamlands that you read about in Lovecraft, it seems to exist from time immemorial, but actually it's just recently imprinted by a previous wave of avant-garde artists, and they discover that they are able to manipulate the Dreamlands for their own ends. And of course, the real-life Surrealists thought that they were going to cause a worldwide psychic revolution that was going to completely change people's minds through art. Now, if you just add Cthulhu to that, that the potential for that is maybe they can go wrong. And indeed, so they start tooling around, first of all, in the slightly twee Dunsinane Dreamlands. And then as they, when they come back later, they find out that, you know, oh, suddenly Czar is filled with furnaces, and that André Breton's hero who died when he was 18 of an opium overdose, i.e. died while dreaming, he exists in the Dreamland, and he's taking all the poets of Czar and putting them in the furnaces. And over here, you know, the lake is turning into melting clocks, and the Minotaurs suddenly have chests of drawers sprouting from them, or they're big Picasso-style, hideous, malformed Minotaurs.
But the furnaces, I was going to say, wait, did Stalinist Russia leak into the Dreamlands as well? Or? No,
the Surrealists, of course, according to their angry and frustrated leader, were Stalinists. They were Stalinists avant la lettre and then après la lettre.
Right. Actually, that's one thing that Breton had going for him, is that among the French intellectual left, he was the first one, basically, to go, oh, wait, Moscow show trials, something's awry here, right? He gets, among French communists, he gets points for realizing that there was something wrong. Now,
right.
You know, he didn't then go, off to the right, but he did become a Trotskyist. The interactions between him and the Communist Party are quite comical, because he would show up saying, here's this
bowl full of fur that we made. How do we use this to assist the revolution? And they would try to assign him to like sit down with the proletariat and learn,
teach pottery.
Yeah, right.
Can you make it into a cup?
And Andrew Breton is this fascinating contradictory figure because he is super doctrinaire, even though he's supposedly a surrealist, and he's a, you know,
doctrinaire surrealist,
yeah. Super doctrinaire surrealist, and he would like throw people out of the movement all the time, and there's this whole group.
So he did learn something from Stalin.
Yeah, absolutely,
but maybe not a sense of irony,
right? Or he did not have a sense.
Does
of
anyone irony. Get hit in the head with an ice pick, or no, sorry, an ice axe at some point?
In the Dreamlands, but the thing is, Andrew,
there's all kinds of melee weapons.
His big irony is that, unlike all of the other surrealists, he's too literal-minded to ever go into the Dreamlands. And so he's one of the major non-player characters. And the thing is, when you start to research all of these figures, there's stuff that you do not have to make up anything more to make them Cthulhu characters.
Right.
So Tristan Tzara, who's the impresario who brought Dada to Paris and then was then eclipsed by Breton, he was supposed to come to Paris a year earlier than he did, but he wouldn't because he was afraid of the foremost entity that was haunting him and trapping him in his apartment.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know.
I would be too.
Yeah.
Or, so, yeah. Once again, Mr. Tynes has proved right. When you scratch history, it bleeds.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the poet Paul Eluard, who at the time...
you're going to really compare Eluard to Tynes?
No.
Tynes has produced more words.
Fewer of them in French.
Yeah.
He was at the time he was married to Gala, who was later Gala Dali. And in 1926, he suddenly disappears. He steals money from his father's business, disappears off the face of the earth to go to the South Seas in search of something mysterious. And
we presume he found it.
And Max Ernst finally goes to rescue him in Saigon. So, you know, our work here is
Saigon.
Really.
Steal fucking Saigon.
Right.
I asked for a mission, and for my sins, they gave me a melting clock.
And so the character set sections, the biographies of all of these characters and their intertwining chronologies, and you decide when you want to start and mm-hmm. when you want to finish, are all written in the second person. So the character description for Antoine Artaud, the crazy theater visionary, describes his slow descent into madness as just, you know, you are being raped by Cthulhoid entities and other people think you're crazy.
Yeah.
Wow. And all you have to do is write down what Artaud thought was happening to him. He thought he was going to, you know, bring about a psychic inbreak. He thought he was going to bring about the apocalypse with his magical cane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think as you do.
As one does. And so that's so there's that section. There's a Paris section. There's a geography of the Dreamlands both before and after the surrealist inbreak. There's descriptions of the creatures both before and after they're altered by the influence
the
of the
Zeitgeist. Surrealist.
Yeah. There's an adventure, of course. And then there's a companion volume called the Livre de Formas, the Book of Ants, which is the chronology of the involvement of the surrealists with the Dreamlands by a poet who, by the end of it, well, it turns out that something weird is up with him as well. And that's something that you can just read as a piece of fiction, or you can read it for inspiration.
Yeah.
Or what
is this something where you it's got to come with the canned characters or historical figures, or can you be injected as into the scenario as another, you know, lost generation, post-World War One, post-crash kind of?
I was trying to nudge people toward playing the historical characters because they're so much richer and more complicated and have those weird histories, but you absolutely can, you know, create your own character if you want to.
It sounds like it would have to be an awfully educational source book, you know? There's sort of so specific and there's so much detail that...
it's going to run great as long as every box comes with Robin Laws.
Amazing.
Well, I mean, obviously it runs better if you've got a bunch of surrealist fans running it, but... Since everyone's responsible, if they're playing one surrealist, they're responsible for their own guide.
Get a sense.
If you're playing Dali, you only have to know Dali. If you're playing Magritte, you only have to know Magritte. The GM can know as much or as little as they want, just like with every other game.
Mm-hmm.
They can know, you know, there's sort of a broad outline. This is when Picasso shows up. This is who he's a jerk to. This is who's fighting with Jean Cocteau. so that you can sort of improv from that. And if no one else knows anything about surrealism, it's not like they can catch you.
Yeah.
Plus, Robin has got a thing in the book for people being each other's surrealist dream duplicates that show up in Paris just in case history turns out that, nope, Max Ernst was actually in Cape Town during my campaign, but oh well.
I was going to say, like, between this and Scott's work on World War One, you could set up an entire college course of curriculums, like early 20th century history through Cthulhu.
That's right.
Well, now there's a marketing pitch. It's yeah. like taking a college course.
Right. It's like Ross and his friends keep joking without laughing too much about it that they wish they could get college credit for all of Scott.
I do feel like I learned quite a bit from Glancy's games. I feel like I know more about Manchuria and Siberia
than you really ever wanted to. Believe me, my wife feels the same way, because when I was doing the research, every time I came across something horrible, I yeah. had to tell her. And she learned to just go, that's nice to hear.
The
spicy shrimp go to that guy. Yeah. These are quite substantial as appetizers go.
I'm not sure if you've ever been to America, Scott. That's how we eat here.
That's an appetizer. Mm-hmm. Well, okay then.
Are you not appetized?
Are you not appetized? Clearly they're not screwing around here.
And yeah. when does this podcast drop?
We can put it up whenever, so...
A week or two, probably.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you a little scoop from the Stone Skin Press side of things. You may know Shotguns v. Cthulhu, which is our previous mm-hmm. fiction anthology that we did through Stone Skin Press, which is Pellegrin's fiction arm. It has at least three people at this table have stories in it, and we're doing a follow-up called Letters to Lovecraft. The premise of this anthology is that all of the writers will look at Lovecraft's essay, Supernatural Horror and Literature, and find a little bit of it that they want to respond to, and they'll write a little preamble about what it is whether they want to argue with that or support something he's saying, and that's a very Lovecraftian essay in that there are incredibly great incisive points about weird fiction right next to batshit lunacy as consecutive sentences, and of course most of the batshit lunacy is racist ethnically reductionist at the very least, and then each writer will then write a story which is not necessarily, and in fact probably mostly not, directly a mythos story, but a reaction to the weird tales tradition and what Lovecraft had to say about that. And that's being edited by the novelist Jesse Bullington, who did the Sad Tale of the Brothers Grossbart. And he's lining up a really great lineup of writers to do the short stories of that. And so we're very stoked about that, which we've not yet officially announced, but I guess I just quasi-officially.
Well, very cool. So is that sort of far enough along that you figure it's going to be next year?
It's going to be next year. He's just now in the very, very early stages.
Gotcha. Good, good deal.
Well, it must be a great lineup of writers. They haven't contacted me.
They're still mid-barrel.
So the anthology is going to be like stories based on responding to elements of supernatural horror? Are they going to be nonfiction essays or?
They're fiction stories that then pivot off of whatever point.
They're fictional stories. So all right.
So,
I will disprove this point by writing a story that
exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or right. This point I think is correct and it inspired me to write this
story. Amplify it and what? Neat.
It's a novel approach. I like that. I don't think I've heard of it. An anthology that takes that primitive. Like, you're wrong, and I will show you.
Right. Well, it's hard to find, obviously, new themes for Lovecraft inspired fiction, and it's still a big category. The mainstream books distributors want more of it. So I thought this was a great way of, engaging writers who, otherwise might, not want to do a straight Lovecraft prestige, but have something to say about the tradition and to say it through a piece of their own writing.
Right. Right.
Well, it's been some years since I've read Supernatural Horror and Literature, but that just makes me want to go back and dig into it immediately to try and mine it.
Excuse me.
Interesting. Are you just responding directly to the essay itself, or are you going to be like using any of the criticism of it, like Josie's?
Well, it'll be up to each individual writer how they want to go with it. The actual critical response is just a pretty short, you know, little intro, so it's no more than like, you know, 150, 300 words. Because really the point is to...
So nobody would be moving outside of that essay into some of his other, you know, letters or things where we have to scold him about, you know, black people can't use the same pages as white people.
Oh, there's plenty of racism in the main essay that they...
thank goodness.
Right.
Less overt support of Mussolini. But.
Right. but if anybody wants to, you know, say anything about Lovecraft or the tradition through that lens, I mean, you know, we're not, you know, given the caliber of the people that Jesse's lining up, we're not going to slap their wrist if they color outside the lines a little.
Yeah. I mean, it's an ongoing source of controversy. I mean, every so often the question comes up where there's detractors and defenders and the issue of, well, is it okay if I like this, even though he was such an asshole so much of the time, you know?
And what we will forgive in Lovecraft, apparently we will not forgive for Orson Scott Card.
Well,
Orson Scott Card has the advantage or disadvantage of having written 80 years later.
Right. Lovecraft has the advantage of being dead.
Yes. Right. you can't exactly go with the, it was a different time. Oh, no, wait, it's this current time. It was actually 2 days ago.
He's still saying it, in fact.
Also, Lovecraft died relatively early. Orson Scott has had the time to reflect upon his views, so.
And double down.
So you heard it here first. Ross Payton calls for a fatwa on Orson Scott's time.
It'll be fine, I'm sure. I just see that trailer of that movie, and I'm like, I'm really so sure about that.
But, well, in fairness, that was my response to the trailer, regardless of Orson Scott Card.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But don't worry, Orson, we don't hate you for your views. We actually just hate the movie.
Well, Ken, what's up with you these days?
Well, I'm contributing the Occult Paris chapter to Dreamhounds of Paris.
Ooh,
so that there will be lots of fascist conspiracies wandering around, causing trouble, various magical traditions both fading and reviving, as they tend to. Paris, of course, is like the center of occult espionage in the Western world for the 50 years on either side of the Surrealist movement, so there's lots of stuff to put in there, from the proto-Priore de Sion back to, you know, whatever Pappus was doing in Russia at the court of the Tsars. There's all kinds of stuff that, you know, I'll write until I hit word count, and Simon tells me I can't keep writing. And I may drop in a couple of things into the geography of Paris section, just depending on how thorough Steve Dempsey was doing it.
Not to set Ken off on an enormous rant, but I got to ask a question about...
Remember, kids, everything before the butt, in a sense, is a lie.
You know, when it comes to cultism in Europe, it always seems to be really heavily weighted towards the far right. In this period of time, as opposed to, it doesn't seem to enter into the left the way at all. I mean, you know,
there are visionary leftist occultists. Maxim Gorky was the center of a circle of them in Russia. There was a guy named Gleb Boki, who was the cryptographer for Lenin, who was also basically a theosophist and an occultist. But they were all purged in 36, 37, 38. So in the Trail of Cthulhu era, you're seeing them, you know, being purged. It's the great recall of the illegals when the Yezhov was purging the GRU and the MVD by calling back all the agents to Moscow for consultation.
Yeah.
And if you have read your Spanish Civil War history, you know how many of the Soviet agents got sort of rotated out because they were not hardcore all-the-line Stalinists.
My understanding is that it was that there's an idea that every espionage organization eventually is infiltrated. I mean, networks have a lifespan. They send you good information, eventually they are infiltrated, they send you bad information, so the plan was, we'll just kill them, and then we'll know we're not getting bad information from them anymore.
But like Tim Powers did in Declare, and like you can do in this setting, especially if Andrea Bertrand keeps trying to tell the French Communist Party, but look, I have proof of this transcendent reality. There may be some, you know, Soviet commissar out there who is trying to either kill all the gates to it or control all the gates to it for the party, and that's going to be another possible agenda. The left was so materialistic that their ability to be occultist was hampered, but if you, for example, broaden your notion of the left to include people like Gandhi, the Indian nationalist movement was heavily influenced by theosophy and was heavily occultist. So it really depends.
One of the major surrealists, the poet Louis Aragon, goes total Stalinist when his Russian wife shows up and pursues and marries him, and so the imputation in the Dreamhounds continuity is that in fact he is on behalf of Moscow trying to shut down all of the gates to the Dreamlands, and there's sort of a hint of what an sequel might be outside the bounds of the Trail timeline, which is that in the 40s, Aragon and a lot of other of the surrealists detailed in the book become figures in the resistance. And there's also the indication that that during World War II, because there's like a Leonardo Carrington painting that shows the Dreamlands iced over, that as the war comes, the Dreamlands sort of ice over, everything's encrusted with ice, but the surrealists can still move through the tunnels into the Dreamlands and use that to hide material and stuff. So if Ken and I actually lived in the same city, this is the campaign one of us would be running for the other.
Yeah, right. So that's the immediate thing that I'm doing for Robin's Dreamhounds. I'm also putting together, continuing the editing and playtesting on the Mythos Expeditions anthology, which is, I forget if it's 8 or 9 adventures, all of which take place on expeditions. So the old go to the place, horrible thing. Why would I go to that place?
The Mythos landmine.
Right.
Ride to the encounter.
They're all period for trail. They're all in the 1930s. Well, the assumed character is a Miskatonic University professor or associate, and there's going to be a sort of a framing sequence how you can use this as the skeleton of an Armitage Inquiry campaign. You know, for each of the things, what do you bring back to Arkham? What effect does it have on future adventures if you brought something back from Paraguay or Papua New Guinea or wherever? Sort of an attempt to build out a method by which the players can track the degree to which they have informed Henry Armitage of the dangers, while of course probably dooming Arkham by putting too large a critical mass of madness together in the Orne Library's basement.
Yeah, just put it next to the other Mythos Plutonium.
Yeah, they probably won't fight.
Don't worry about it. Someone will just go crazy.
Artifacts don't fight. Artifacts mostly don't fight. Here's a report you can read. And so the true journals of the expedition become a Mythos tome that you can use to, continue the fight.
Yeah.
So that's the approach we're taking on Mythos Expeditions, which I'm doing. There's some individual PDFs that are coming in that we're probably going to put out. I'll have more details on those once we have more details on those. There's one or two that are sort of in the early stages. We're thinking maybe of doing a number of rural setting ones and doing a companion to Out of Time and Out of Space called Out of the Woods. That's something that I'd like to, do for...
Would those be set in, Lovecraft country or just anywhere?
Just generally rural America.
Rural America. So
it could be, New England, or it could be, we have a really good one that I think it's set in Appalachia that I don't know if I've got yet or not, but I've got the proposal for it. So that's basically the Trail of Cthulhu there. My next big trail book will be Deathless China, but I have to sort of get other stuff done before Simon will say, no, yes, I'm going to pay you to watch Kung Fu films for 3 months. And but
is that just focusing on the 30s as well?
Yes, Trail of Cthulhu takes place in the 1930s. There's no, with the exception, of course, of the out of time scenario.
That's what I was saying.
There's no real benefit to, pre-forking our audience. I like the idea of providing that as some constraint. And it's not like China in the 1930s is boring.
Right.
There is a lot going on, and the book could swell to be enormous if we let it. So it's going to be the next big mountain to climb for Trail of Cthulhu for me anyway.
All right. And, of course, your Osprey books.
Yes.
Are very exciting.
Yes. The Nazi Occult for Osprey is out now. There are Mythos hints scattered in it for those who keep their eyes open.
Easter eggs.
Easter eggs, if you will. Easter Island eggs, perhaps. And Osprey has approached me about another book, which is not going to be a sequel to The Nazi Occult, and I probably shouldn't say anything before the contract is signed, but if the contract matches my proposal, people in the of the Unspeakable Oath affinity will, I think, appreciate it a great deal, and there will be lots more examples of me making Osprey production artists do horrible, horrible things.
Yeah, I actually reviewed Nazi Occult for Roleplaying Bubble Raider. I really enjoyed it. Although, I'd actually, just before I read your book, I read a book called Grimoires, which is a history of magic books.
Yeah, by Owen Davies.
Yes, by Owen Davies. It's very excellent. So I recognized some of the references you were making. And for me, it was interesting to see how you were blurring like history and the occult. So it's kind of like wondering.
Pretty much his job.
Yeah, well, I know.
25 years.
But it's like someone who's not knowledgeable about like the subject could read Nazi Occult and think that it's a nonfiction book up until the point he gets to the illustrations. Like, yes. Yeah, the text. If he just was reading an ebook version without the pictures, it
or some of the readers maybe more convinced than ever.
Yeah, the guy from the Skeptical Inquirer has written a review on Amazon, and I don't know if it's ever going to run in the Skeptical Inquirer magazine now that the founder is under sexual harassment charges or whatever it is. But yeah. The review was calling out the book for not having a disclaimer, and it's like. A disclaimer is not going to stop anyone who believes that the Nazis could really turn into werewolves.
Right.
There are two kinds of brands.
Of course he's telling us this is all false.
This is a fake out.
The government is making him say
that. And people are asking, I can't tell what's real and what's not real. It's like, well, did you see the part where the Nazi opened the Necronomicon and his face melted off? That's made up.
The part where the djinn is being fired out of the barrel of the Panzer IV?
That's right.
That's a fictional part. Well,
it's not a Panzer IV.
It's
the Wirbelwerfer
first clue.
Vortex cannon, which was real, fired off the back of the Greif half track. It's mounted on a half track.
Well, in my defense, I haven't seen the book yet.
Oh,
I've not cracked open your book yet, and you know why?
Because I'm
out of money, and if I open it, I will burst into tears
like a child. Well,
like a child.
If only.
Here's your Christmas present. Nope.
None for you. Well, when you see it, you will hopefully be able to tell the factual werewolves from the fake werewolves. And if not, I owe the Skeptical Inquirer a Coke.
Well, you know, the skeptical movement is very, very, very concerned about other people's stupidity.
Yes, which, you know, I suppose one is concerned with the sin one desperately fears in oneself.
Others
like the Pray Away the Gay movement. The Skeptical Inquirer movement has a similar dark secret.
Yeah, that's a lot of time on your knees trying to make the gay go away.
Yes.
Just saying.
So to speak.
What's the line? Other people's habits are most in need of policing.
Robin, to gracefully segue.
Before we continue beating up the Pentecost.
Yeah.
Speaking of play show.
Robin, you're terrific.
Yeah.
Tell us, what's it like to be so terrific?
I was actually going to talk about Esoteric Second Edition because that just came. I mean, it's not Cthulhu per se, but it is Gumshoe and it is very horrific.
It kind of opened the whole door for Trail. Yeah.
It's the original Gumshoe game and its original horror game, and it's a modern agents against the occult. So if you dig Delta Green, it's in that wheelhouse. So basically, we've released a second edition of Esoteros. People are wondering whether the rules are changed enough that if they need to buy the new book for the new rules, and the answer is no, you do not, because I changed how initiative works. Full stop. So what this is a response to the number one criticism of the Esoteros, which is we like this, but it's not a fat enough book. So we have fattened the book with all sorts of delicious modern day conspiracy and weirdness and cognitive dissonance, including a Gareth Hanrahan campaign frame called Station Duty, where rather than performing disparate missions all around the world, you are stationed in one place that has an ongoing problem that you have to deal with, and it's sort of you're
a hellmouth, if you will.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you're developing your relationship to this one place over time.
So there's no reason to buy it for the extra piece of mechanic, but oh my God, there's so many other reasons you need to buy this.
Exactly. So because that's what people wanted. They wanted more setting stuff and more cool story ideas, which of course is, you know, what we're about at Gumshoe.
No, that's the Terrace that's produced them. I really enjoyed the Book of Unremitting Horror. That was probably one of my, in recent years, one of my favorite monster manual type books. Have you guys seen that? It is, who did the art? I mean, the really great Black Monday illustration.
Dave Alsop.
Yeah. And it's very original monster ideas, like not just like it's a zombie, but hey, it has wings or something.
And they're all psychologically destabilizing, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yes, they'll dismember you, but that's the part that you're grateful for after the psychological torture that they subject you to.
Yeah.
And so now whenever I try to create new esoteric monsters called Outer Dark Entities, I try to follow Adrian Bott, the writer, and Dave Alsop's vision and make sure that they're really emotionally disturbing monsters. So it's, you know, the weird sort of dusty dust bunny creature thing that inhabits the corpse of your loved one and starts ordering you to do things. That sort of thing.
I'm so glad the monkeys are playing in the background.
It is a bit of like an Unknown Armies game all of a
sudden. I'm really hoping that as he's describing his creature there that they can hear.
I'm a believer on the,
yeah.
On the soundtrack.
Peter Tork is suddenly sitting up full of dust bunnies.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think they're singing I'm a Believer.
Yeah. Very good. I'm a Believer. They're just fans of Justin Bieber.
Maybe.
The true horror.
Well, one thing that while we're here that I was kind of hoping to explore a little bit is looking at Trail and looking at Call of Cthulhu, and we're all fans of both of them, but they play and they sort of deliver different things. You know, I mean, Trail, the impetus for Trail, and you guys obviously correct me if I'm not saying it right, was to kind of deliver what Call of Cthulhu sort of sets out to deliver, but to be more direct about it.
To ensure that it's delivered.
Right, and to sort of skip, you know, Call of Cthulhu because it's, you know, I mean, it's a product of its time, even though it's a classic and I still love it to pieces, it still has RuneQuest-style combat rules in it, and when you put RuneQuest-style combat rules in it, people are going to want to have RuneQuest-style combat. And so that winds up then in a lot of games kind of derailing things in a way that's that may be kind of dysfunctional for getting people to the scary kind of existential cosmic crisis that you're after. And then of course there's the whole skill roll thing that every Call of Cthulhu GM eventually stumbles over, or in some cases stumbles over the very first time they play the game and never stop stumbling over, you know, as to When do you actually ask for a skill roll, and when do you realize that making them have a chance of failing at it is maybe not the best option? So, but that's the thing that I'm kind of interested in, is hearing your experiences now that Trail's been out in circulation and in play for quite a while, as to sort of comparing, contrasting the experience of play, you know, and what it's like at the table in your experiences and what you've heard from people.
Well, mostly what I hear from people about Trail is, you know, very gratifying. You know, we really liked it. It was great fun. We enjoyed it. We couldn't figure out what you were trying to say about the stability system. Things like that, you know. But the felt experience of play, I compare it not so much to doing something better than Call of Cthulhu, which I insist is heresy. Call of Cthulhu is the greatest role-playing game ever. It is still the greatest role-playing ever.
And don't worry, it's going to be even better in 7th edition.
As fun as that would be. As much as everyone liked our Pray Away the Gay rant, the notion that that I would go back to is that King Lear is the greatest piece of drama ever written, the greatest piece of human literature ever written. But as a samurai movie, it lacks a certain something. Ron adapts King Lear to a samurai movie. Call of Cthulhu is the greatest role-playing game ever written. As a detective game, it's lacking a certain something. It has certain obstacles and certain mechanical features that make, if your focus on the game is the investigation, it makes it harder than not. Trail of Cthulhu takes one part of the Call of Cthulhu experience, not the whole Call of Cthulhu experience, because the RuneQuest-style combat is a part of the Call of Cthulhu experience, and the broken investigation, the frustration of going mad, knowing that the horror is out there and you're unable to stop it as part of the Call of Cthulhu experience. There's a lot of the Call of Cthulhu experience because it's Tula horror, Tula Lovecraft. Trail is more focused than that. It has the luxury and the advantage of taking one aspect of the game and making that aspect and foregrounding that aspect. So when people come back to me and they say, we really, really like Trail, well, they're running the scenarios that we wrote for it, or they're running scenarios like the ones that we wrote for it, which are designed to emphasize that. Because we are not writing Trail of Cthulhu scenarios in which the goal of the thing is to get a hold of, you know, a stockpile of BARs and mow your way through the cannibal hordes in Kazakhstan or wherever, right? That's not what...
Why are you looking at me when you say that?
For two obvious reasons. One, you're enormous. You fill my eye line. And second, because that's how Scott Glancy rolls.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Yeah. If you hadn't said anything, people would have imagined. And so anyway, so the reason that we're writing those scenarios is to focus that kind of play. And unsurprisingly, when people are trying for that kind of play, they get a focused experience out of it.
Right.
And when I run Gumshoe, I find it's a better shorthand for the way that I run games anyway, which is to tend to be player empowering, if not player character empowering, on the grounds that, and I learned this back running Call of Cthulhu, if I let the players have all the rope they want, they're never going to make a net to catch anything. They're always going to make a series of nooses.
Right.
And so Trail of Cthulhu just makes that easier and more direct, and there isn't the annoying delay before the players kill themselves that there is in a lot of other games.
Sometimes we have people playtest trail scenarios using the call rules, and you would think that the biggest difference would be what happens if they fail to get the information. And although that's a problem, an even bigger difference is that Trail uses drives, gives every character a reason for why do you behave like a Lovecraft character. Because, of course, player characters can become self-protective and go, well, we're not going down in there and down in that crypt. Well,
right.
Okay, in that case, you're not the protagonist of this story. Give me some other protagonists who are going to do the things that
that's where the story is down there.
Yeah. Because Trail just handles that by, you know, requiring you to think about it, Call of Cthulhu sometimes leaves people go, well, we just left the island.
Mm-hmm.
Your adventure is
it, it often kind of assumes yeah. that the keeper is going to know that the adventure is down there, so.
Well, it's not just that, it's not the keeper will know that the adventure is down there, but that the, you know, the players will play the game. And I admit that when it comes to that, I like the idea of the motives to, you know, but it feels like, in some ways, I feel like it's boxing the player in. If I have a group of players who are presented with a problem, the solution which is down that hole in the ground, and they go, well, I'm not going down there, I'm like, my general attitude is, well, then why are we playing this game? However, motivations on characters in mechanics, and I'm trying to think of another system that does this, I guess.
No, maybe, Wild Talent, certainly.
I think
Pen Dragon, obviously.
Yeah.
Hollywood Expedition does that as well.
I think with Trail, what I like about the drives is it actually provides you not just a mechanical, but sort of an in-character impetus for that that doesn't require you to step out of character and have the conversation of, will you realize you're breaking the game here?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It kind of allows you to stay kind of in play while that discussion is sort of happening.
Right, and there's a sort of a fig leaf of mechanics to, you know, if you ignore your drive, this bad thing happens. Mm-hmm. But that never gets to that point, because all you do is, when you're having that moment where you've gone wobbly, all the GM has to do is say, well, yeah, but remember, you're gung-ho for adventure. Mm-hmm. Oh, right, of course, yeah, sure, I would do that, right. So that's as far as it ever gets. So
clearly none of the drives in the game are, you know, live a quiet, normal life at home and raise children.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that drive
does not exist.
There's the drive that's the reverse of that, which is ennui. Normal life has bored you to tedium, and therefore you deliberately court destruction.
Destruction.
That actually makes a great motivation in Godlike, where you have no choice to actually go live a normal life except to...
Yes, once you've been identified by, you know, the government as being special.
Right.
You know, congratulations, Patriot. Yeah. We're going to the front.
But that's the difference. I mean, in things like Trail and Public, you generally, the characters, the player characters are there of their own volition. And so what you want is to encourage them to keep of their own volition getting into horrible situations that are going to be entertainingly disastrous.
And I find that between Drives and Pillars of Sanity, mm-hmm. You get a good handle on your character, and it really enables some character-driven play that's supported by the mechanics, whereas Call of Cthulhu basically leaves it up to you.
Yeah, right. That is completely
what kind of guy is your guy?
Yeah, very explicitly.
Which is great if you are a player who wants to proactively sort of take charge and say, mm-hmm. you know, here's my guy, and this is why he's nervous, and this is why he sweats a lot, and this is all of his other beliefs. But we give characters stats and abilities and, you know, lines on the sheet for a reason. Mm-hmm. And one of those reasons is as aids to role-playing and as guides to story. And I think that by giving the GM targets to shoot for, you really focus play. And I think that's another thing that really Trail does well in terms of taking the seemingly mechanistic, I'm here to investigate mysteries and follow the trail of clues, and adds the character component back in.
Well, they've added it in as part of the actual mechanics.
Right,
and
yeah.
And I, you know, part of my resistance to that was the idea, and again, it's, that resistance has sort of failed over the years after being exposed to...
You have worn him down.
Well, you and several other game systems, Trail and several other game systems, have provided these motivations built into character mechanic. And my initial response to that was always, you know, what kind of gamer are you? You can't come up with a character who has motivations for why you would want to be involved in this sort of a game. What are you, a lame-o? But that's the same kind of thinking that says pre-generated characters are for pussies. You know, only communists use pre-generated characters. I want to, you know, unless you're rolling your character up, there's no point in playing. And I, you know, I've gotten to a point where I think pre-gens are, you know, perfect for a small one-off game.
But again, you might as well say... what kind of role player needs a sheet to tell him how strong he is?
But, you know,
if it has a effect on story.
But not everyone's going to be a 45-year-old played for 30 years role player who's gotten used to the idea of stepping in and out of characters and developing your own motivation. Anything that's going to help, especially bring people into this who've never done it before, that will provide, you know, something that will help guide them in their initial encounter with the game. Or even their initial encounter with role-playing, that's a good thing.
Yeah, but my point is Trail of Cthulhu doesn't have a stat to say how strong you are.
Right.
It has an athletic stat, but you might not be real strong. You're just really nimble. And that's something you've decided. And it's the same way that the other blank spaces on a Call of Cthulhu character sheet or another kind of character sheet inspire you to fill it in. No character sheet, thank God, fills in every detail of your character.
They tried.
There's always
fatal, didn't they?
Some aspect. No character sheet fills in every aspect of your character, full stop. But what Trail of Cthulhu tries to do is find the places the character intersects with the story and provide maximum mechanical support for that. And that's what all the Gumshoe games do within their own genres.
You know, I have yet to have a chance to play Trail. I've read it all. I've gone through all the, you know, read a bottle of scenario books. I find the way that your scenarios are laid out to be sort of remind me of like the sort of a James Ellroy kind of clipped way that the scenarios are set up. They're in a very efficient sort of shorthand to move the players through the investigation from scene to scene.
They kind of have to be that way.
Well, on the one hand, I think, cutting into your word count, man, how are you going to get paid? But on the other hand, it really does provide a great deal of efficiency for packing material in.
Right, and also to be useful as a reference while you're running the adventure.
Because it's so open that you can look and quickly reference each scene, each section, and all the material that's in it without having to dig into column after column like you do in the average pagan.
I mean, if you look at my old copy of Shadows of Yog-Sothoth that I ran the first big campaign I ran in Call of Cthulhu, ran it when it came out, and you will look in my copy and you will see underlining in red everywhere there was a crucial scene component.
Right.
And then in green are my notes of how I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
Now, in Trail, we try and meet the GM halfway We can't tell him how he's going to change it, but we can certainly underline in red.
Mm-hmm. Right. And bullet points and all those other things further that, because there are a lot of scenarios that are really great to read, and they're written in sort of a quasi-prose sort of screenplay style. And if you're not going to run them, that's the format you want, right? That's delightful. But and lots of people, that's their only chance to play.
That does happen really a lot.
Just oh, no, of, you just, sort of you just described the last 10 years of Pagan Publishing.
Right.
Sorry. That's...
But if you're actually going to run it, you know, having all the stuff called out and be right there for you is a big thing, because otherwise you have to dive through, you know, in some ways the better written it is, the harder it is to find the stuff that you need, and the harder it is to add your own level of description and stuff. So we try to strike a balance between here's some sort of canned narration to paraphrase, and just here's the bullet points of how you're going to maybe...
In a lot of ways, your scenario is almost written in a... I don't want to say it's an outline form, but there seem to be an enormous amount of very really direct the referee, so that they can sit there with this thing right in front of them as the instruction manual, and you know,
we've all of us written adventures, you know. I think we've all written for Cthulhu games, and you start off, if you're going to be running it, you don't start with 30 pages of polished prose, right? I mean, you generally are going to start with outline and points and, you know, little things scribbled in the margins, and it's very, and it's exactly like that. And so as you're, if the traditional approach to turning that into fully fleshed out prose has its advantages, you know, one of which is it's more enjoyable to just read it as a reading experience. But the advantage to keeping it closer to that outline is the reason that outline is playable is because you get a lot more information that you need that you're going to then, you know, transfigure through your own brain into what you're saying out loud.
A published trail scenario looks like the notes I made to run the game before I wrote it down.
Right. And then that's not accidental, right?
Yeah.
No.
And one of the advantages that we find when we're writing in the sort of the telegraphic style is that gives us more room within the word count to add more potential information. I know when I write a scenario, there's a lot of 0 points clues, right, that aren't core clues, but are clues that you get anyway just by being in the surroundings. And because I don't have to spend, you know, 7 paragraphs laying out the core clue, I can take 3 of those paragraphs and come up with 3 different weird things that if you've got physics, you find out about the room, or archaeology, you find out about the room. And I can put in strange crap I found out about Pennsylvania Dutch German legendary, or meteorite falls in Paraguay, or whatever, and slide it in and provide that sort of what I feel is the great one of the great joys of Lovecraft is the fog of actual detail out of which the mystery appears. And I can put that in without ballooning the word count and making it totally unreadable, because people can look and say Height is going off on another bizarre rant about Jack the Ripper, but here's the core clue. And if you're a reader who's like, oh, I love the Jack the Ripper, or I love the Ken Hyatt, they can read as much of that and put as much of that into their game as they want. But if they are not that person, they say, all right, I'm moving on to the next scene. Mm-hmm. We're going to fight a hand of Tendalos.
Right. And the distinction I draw is between telling the story as the adventure writer and mapping the story so that the keeper can run the adventure, and those are two big different things. And
if you
get too much into, you know, you're not telling the story, they will later, and you can fall into the trap of just, well, this happens and this happens, and no, it doesn't.
Yeah,
there's a bunch of things that could potentially happen. Maybe you should be marking out all of those possible branch points.
I sat down with a woman who was an editor of a number of the Cthulhu anthologies at the Lovecraft Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And, you know, well, she's an editor. I said, well, I've edited some stuff. And trying to describe editing a story that doesn't have any protagonists in it made absolutely no sense to her.
You handed her a bowl covered in blue fur and asked how it would forward the revolution.
It's a hypothetical story is what we're writing. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, one thing you mentioned about revealing information, Trail of Cthulhu, I've been running a lot of Call of Cthulhu and Gumshoe games, and I notice in like Gumshoe games, I tend to reveal. I tend to be very generous when giving out clues and allowing 0 point clue things, and just give out tons and tons of expository information. Because one thing I've noticed, the players that play in Gumshoe games tend to be very, they feel very like
whenever they spend a point, like for an investigative ability, that's like a big thing to them.
Yeah.
They're like, oh god, am I, they like, they, some of them are horrid, some of them just feel like, oh god, I'm gonna lose all my points and my one skill and I'm gonna be screwed. So it's like a big thing for them.
There's gotta be a big payoff.
Yeah, so there's gotta be a big payoff. And like in Call of Cthulhu, people are just, I make spot hidden everywhere all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, yeah.
How do your players do a lot of just telling you what they do? Because we've gotten to the stage where after, you know, 25 years of playing Call of Cthulhu, it's like, well, we pull up the carpet in the office. Oh, there's a pentagram again. You know, we've, it's more like us describing how we're searching the room and rolling the dice. And
we pull up the carpet in the office. The secretary looks askance.
Yeah, exactly.
It depends on how
we tell her to shut her pretty mouth.
Hey, things are going easy.
Slap that grin off her face.
No, finally some dice rolling.
Exactly.
I do know, like, well, it's usually, it depends on the type of scenario. The players start getting ambushed and like start getting screwed over in offices. They start getting very paranoid, checking, you know, getting that detail. Most of them, I'll just make a check.
Okay.
But like, I find, there's this whole psychological thing about point spending. And like, I know at least one player who I ran through a Knights Black Agent campaign didn't like the gumshoe system because it felt like his character wasn't as competent or as skilled in Call of Cthulhu. And this is just, after explaining the game mechanics in detail, like, he still just like that spending points was like a thing.
Like he
for
could
him.
Run out of being smart.
Yeah,
at some point.
That was a thing, and he did not like having to spend for those abilities. And I don't know, like, if that's come up in your, if that's unique to my group, or if that's,
well, in effect, that is an intended result that goes a little further than I want.
Yeah.
The whole point of the point spending is, in fact, to create that sense of anxiety and crisis of, you know, I could succeed automatically if I really wanted to.
Yeah.
But do I want to do that now?
Okay.
And if you give somebody a resource, right, there's a little part of the human brain called the insula that governs your instinct not to let go of any resources you have gathered, which is very important when you're foraging for nuts in the Mesozoic era or
Skyrim.
The Paleolithic era. And so your desire to conserve that resource is an important emotion that I'm trying to draw out and mess with you a little. And it's if you're into the straight power fantasy of being ultra competent all the time, rolling constantly with a high result and no cost of ever trying things, that's more empowering. But most of the games that we use with Gumshoe are things that are meant to be tense in some way or another, whether it's the tension of the horror genres that we're talking about here, or the moral tension of Ashen Stars, or the sort of existential tension of, are you a human anymore, that underlies Mutant City Blues. And so because all of these things are, you know, yes, I'm messing with you, Ross's player.
Yeah.
And that's a feature, not a bug.
It'll be okay. It'll be okay. You can always refresh.
Well, his character met an appropriate end, and then Knights Black Agent came in. I don't want to spoil it, because I'm going to post him on the podcast, but It was cosmic. It was poetic.
So, Ken and Robin, do either of you, you're still running traditional Call of Cthulhu, right?
Right now I'm running a Coda system space game.
Oh, okay.
I have run traditional Call of Cthulhu since writing Trail of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
Yes.
So are there? What I'm curious about is are there sort of, you know, when you have, on the one hand, I could start a trail game, on the other hand, I could start a traditional Call of Cthulhu game. Where does your decision-making happen?
But I don't really get to decide, per se, what I'm going to run. I offer suggestions to the players, and then they pick from among them. Right now, I have one core member of my playgroup who will remain nameless, but his initials are C. Neumeier, who is, shall we say, a big baby about Lovecraft and doesn't want to play in a Cthulhu game. So for the, you know, immediate future, and, you know, certainly he's a very excellent player in virtually any other game that you want to name. And he was he played the priest who used to work with Solidarity funneling guns from the CIA to them in the Knights Black Agents playtest. So he doesn't mind horror, he just doesn't like Lovecraft.
Okay.
So the trail versus call decision doesn't really come up, but...
Yeah. Well, let's say hypothetically.
Hypothetically, some of it might depend on, do I have a setting in Trail that I'm trying to write and playtest? Some of it hypothetically might be, are my players really enthused about Call? Are they like old school, you know, Chaosium heads like I am? Some of it might be, am I trying to playtest a new, say, Delta Green core engine, perhaps? That might be a question.
Hypothetically.
So a lot of it is, it's going to sort of depend on where the player's comfort zone is and on the specific sort of meta needs of the game.
But you don't look at the two systems and think, well, I can only have this kind of game with Trail, and I can only have this kind of Cthulhu game with Call of Cthulhu. That's not what I'm talking about.
Well, if I were running a game, say, that was based on being skeevy, desperate booksellers in London, I'd probably run it with Bookhounds of London, because I optimized it for that.
Yeah.
And if I ran a pulp China adventure game in Trail of, in the Cthulhu mythos, I'd probably use Trail just because I'm going to write Deathless China.
Okay.
But I would not say... This game, I suspect, will have 92% more investigating and 44% less chaotic bloodshed, so I'll run it in Trail, not in Call. That's not really a calculus that I make, but when I make that calculus, it's usually about, you know, a third of the way into the campaign, where it's like, well, these are where the game is really humming, this is where the game's not really humming. I should play more to this side and less to this side, or I should do something that bulks up where I'm weak in the campaign so that the whole play is more satisfying. But I don't necessarily begin, certainly in a narrow universe of Cthulhu-based gaming, I don't immediately begin and say, I can see all the way to the end of this and I know how the play is going to go. Mm-hmm. If I've got an extra reason to focus, I'll focus. But if not, you know, it's just as easy for me to run one as the other. They use slightly different muscles, but it's like, you know, boxing versus... kickboxing. It's still basically, you're getting to the ring, there's going to be a lot of blood and teeth on the mat by the time you're done.
Right, it's basic. It's the difference between a Sharpie and a paper mate, right? There are certain tasks for which only one of them will do, but most of them it's about your preference and the way you think, and I'm, you know, a big advocate of finding rule systems that think the way you do. Mm. Now, I know a whole bunch of rule systems that think the way I do because I designed them.
That does help.
Right. That does help. And because I'm aware of that, you know, I'm reluctant to impose my way of thinking and say that my way of thinking is the best way of thinking about Cthulhu role-playing. But they definitely, you know, they have different flavors, right? It's crunchy versus smooth peanut butter. Right. Some people are going to like one and not the other.
I actually got a merge.
What kind of nerds are you that you're going to draw a bright line and say, "No, oh, Babylon 5 is shit"? No,
we are freelancers. We are freelancers who work for multiple companies.
I say that's the difference.
And know how to find the excitement in whatever.
Every one of these children is beautiful.
No bridges burned. That's right.
I do want to say I actually merged both the Gumshoe and Call of Cthulhu. Yesterday I ran Delta Green. My own scenario, but I can't, because I've been running Knights Black Agents. One of the things the players really did like, all of them, was the preparedness skill. Like, all of them put a lot of points into it. But
everybody likes preparedness.
That's a handy skill.
So what I did was, there was a green box in the scenario, so like I gave the green box a skill of 65%, and like I also didn't like bother to give the players equipment. I didn't type out a shepherd.
The green box in the Delta Green setting is basically a stash. It's like a locker or something where other Delta Green people have stashed stuff for
later.
Yes,
but it's a potluck.
But yeah, you never. They don't keep records, or if they do, the players don't have access to them. So you're told there's a stash,
so
and there
really
may be something useful.
Your green box stat is you're leeching off somebody else's preparedness.
So what the mechanic was like, it started with 65% every time they made a check. If they failed, it would reduce that by 1%. If they made it, then it would reduce it from like 1d6 to 2d6 points.
And you're actually using up more of the.
Yeah, I did have a list of stuff that was already there. That was more like, there is a green box generator website where they have a database of items. You can just type in and how many you want, and it'll pull up a whole list of them. So I copy paste some of
my favorite items from that list are not the ones that are useful, but the items that are like clearly evidence of previous felonies.
There's like a body bag,
human skull halfway sawed through.
right
yeah
now a bunch of flowers taped to the end of a shotgun.
That's
just
I ripped off green boxes as caches in Knights Black Agents. You can spend a point of urban survival, and you know where your agency cached, you know, a stash previously in the city. You go find it. You have to roll a little thing to get to it, and you know, to spend one preparedness point, anything you want is in the cache.
Well, we do have a 1970s surveillance kit and a sawed-off shotgun.
Yeah, so the players really enjoyed that.
Full delivery company. Oh, yeah. Spattered with blood.
Well, so...
This jacket already has blood on it. Did I say already?
Well, guys, let's wrap up.
Yep.
And thank you very, very much, Ken and Robin, for sitting down with us. I ought to say... Ken and Robin happen to run their own podcast that's way, way more frequent than the Unspeakable Oath podcast. Ken and Robin talk about stuff, and it won't surprise anybody to know that everybody here at the table that's not Ken and Robin are big fans of it.
Yes.
Yep.
And
I encourage everyone to go and listen to Ken tell us why Woodrow Wilson is the Antichrist. So. That's my favorite stuff.
All right, well, maybe we'll revisit it just for you.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next time.
Very good.